Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, looking to the cosmos for guidance on how to navigate an already eventful month of March.
And the impacts of potential Medicaid cuts in Arizona.
But first, there is a very unique sculpture installation currently on view at the Desert Botanical Garden. I stopped by recently to check it out.
When you first come in, we're not hitting you with a lot of signs and explaining everything about desert plants. We want you to kind of feel it. It's a sensory experience when you're first coming in. You're definitely meant to spend time here, to be able to sit with it, to take your time.
Last fall, on one of the first evenings when the temperature finally dropped below 80, I drove over to the Desert Botanical Garden, right around sunset. I met up with Laura Spalding Best, the Senior Director of Exhibits, to take a tour of an art installation called Light Bloom. She met me at the entrance to the garden, and we walked in.
We're standing now in Odison Entry Garden. This is kind of the Great Hall of Desert Botanical Garden. So here, this whole space is designed to have this framed view to the Papago Butte back there. Just kind of say, we are all about cactus. Welcome to the Sonoran Desert. You can't mistake it for anything else.
We'd only been walking through the garden for a few minutes when we came to a clearing. The sun was low on the horizon, and the sky was a smear of topaz blue, pale orange, and hazy gray. I stood still for a moment, watching the colors fade. It took me a second to realize that the only reason I could still make out any daylight was because of this trio of dangling metal shapes in the distance. They were each hanging from the top of a giant hoop, and they were catching the last rays of sunset, throwing glimmers and shadows all across the walkway. This, it turned out, was one of the first installations of Light Bloom.
This one's called Inner Orbit. So there's three of these hanging polygons, and these ones are all mirrored steel. So they're in the daytime, they're super shiny, but we actually only open this piece at night. The way that they're arranged in the space, it's most dramatic in the evening.
Watching the fading light reflecting off the mirrored structures, I had the odd sense that I was standing before a kind of gateway, like we were about to enter a strange new world. This, Laura explained, was not an accident.
These artists, Serge and Yelena, the first time they installed a work was for Burning Man 10 years ago. You know, this is definitely a miniature Burning Man moment out here.
Those artists Laura's talking about, Serge Boileau and Yelena Filipchuk, are life partners and collaborators. They work together under the name Hibikozo. For Light Bloom, they partnered with Laura to identify ideal spots in the garden to place their sculptures, which are mostly made of thin metal that looks like mesh, until you get right up close to it. That's when you notice that the sculptures are perforated with intricate tessellations and swirls. As Laura and I walked past one of them, a light bulb mounted inside of it cast flickering shapes on the ground. It looked like the walkway had been replaced with floor tiles in a mosque.
They were invited to create a piece that was inspired by sacred Islamic geometry. And you can absolutely see that influence here.
By now it was dark, and after a while we came to another clearing. At the end of a short path was a rotunda with a tall, slender sculpture at the center. It looked sort of like an unopened crocus bulb. This one was covered in diamond-shaped perforations. It was radiating light from within, all around the rotunda. The sculpture was mounted on a spinning base, and some of the other guests at the garden spun it around, which sent shadows dancing over the surface of a massive cactus.
This is our contemplation garden. It is a contemplative space. You know, you can hear the sounds of water here. But we've placed this piece in the center, and this giant saguaro is right behind it. You could not mistake where you are. You're absolutely here at Desert Botanical Garden.
I paused again, trying to process what I was looking at. The effect of the spinning diamonds on the cactus was mesmerizing. It felt like the saguaro had been transformed from a plant into a canvas. But at the same time, the size of the cactus, looming high above the sculpture, made it so obvious that the spinning metal had been put there by people, that the sculpture and the light had been added to complement something much older and grander. Laura and I kept walking, deeper into the garden, along the base of a butte lined with more cacti. We came to a cutaway in the path where we found the next Hibikozo sculpture, another polygon, this one low to the ground.
This is one of my favorite spots in the garden because on the west side, we have the garden's butte, which is planted with all of our collection plants, organ pipes, saguaros. It's really dramatic, just absolutely iconic Sonoran Desert. And then looking out to the east, all you see are city lights.
I followed Laura's gaze, and it was just like she said. The entire horizon was alive with neon and fluorescent white. Planes and helicopters hovered over our heads, and power lines sliced across the landscape. I looked back at the sculpture, straddling the line between the quiet majesty of the butte and the harsh glare of the urban sprawl. The reason this is one of Laura's favorite places in the garden, she said, is because it's what makes Phoenix special. This extreme concentration of old and new, of pristine desert and metropolitan ambition.
I feel like what you just said made me recognize something about Phoenix that I haven't in the months that I've lived here so far is, because people are often, from back home in New York, people are often saying like, well, what's the deal with Phoenix, basically, in so many words, like, how would you characterize it? And I think it is what you just said. I think it is this sense that it is a city that seems to exist as organically as possible in the balance between the natural and the man-made. Mm. Like, there's an element to the desert that can't be tamed. You can't make life there.
Right.
And one of the things that is interesting to me about Phoenix is that for vast stretches of the city, we haven't tried.
Right.
It's like, nope, that's just the desert and we're not going to put stuff there.
Yeah.
But we have built stuff around it that mimics its color palette and harshness and austerity, and from that the feel of a city emerges.
Yeah, I think there can be this desire if you are a transplant here, if you're new to the area, to try to make this like the environment maybe you're used to.
Like, instead of thinking about how you're not where you used to be, what if you thought about where you are?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest point, is to just like you would accept someone for just how they are if you really love them. That's what you need to do with Phoenix, with the larger valley, with Arizona, with this desert.
Laura and I walked a little further, and we came to one last clearing. There was a final Hibikozo structure, this one so big you could actually climb inside it. So naturally, we did.
If you look through it now, you can see the night sky through these cutouts. The butte, the saguaros, the landscape outside of it is sort of revealed. It's a completely different experience once you step into it.
Light Bloom is on view at Desert Botanical Garden through March 30th.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Today, there are many safe and accessible ways to access birth control for women in the U.S., but it wasn't legalized in this country until 1936. Before that, here in Arizona, there was a movement of birth control advocates who provided it to women across the state, often illegally. And it was led by birth control activist and nurse Margaret Sanger, alongside a group of well-to-do socialites who believed in the effort. In fact, the clinic they founded here evolved into Planned Parenthood of Central and Northern Arizona, an organization still very much around today. I spoke more about it with longtime Arizona historian Mary Melker.
Well, in early Arizona, there was no access to birth control. Women had large families. There was a very high infant mortality rate, and care during childbirth was difficult. It mattered where you lived and if there was a good midwife nearby. Wow. And often people were not delivered by physicians. They were delivered by midwives. So it was a matter of chance whether or not you had adequate care in childbirth. So, I mean, in terms of women's reproductive lives, they were really pretty difficult because they had no control over how many babies they had, and they had a difficult time raising their children because the healthcare was pretty primitive.
And then birth control kind of comes along. It's legalized at some point, but it kind of happens around the same time that a very famous birth control activist, right, Margaret Sanger, comes to Arizona. She lived in Tucson, right?
Right. Yeah. She moved to Tucson in 1934 for the same reason that many people moved to Arizona during this time. And it was to improve a relative's health. Mm. Her grown son suffered from asthma, and doctors recommended that they come to this sunny southwestern state for the climate.
Yeah.
She had already been involved in the birth control movement since the 1910s, starting clinics. She had gotten arrested. She'd served time in jail.
Yeah.
But she thought it was very important that women had access to birth control.
What are we talking about when we're talking about birth control in this era?
The pill didn't come in until about 1962.
Yeah.
She was distributing diaphragms, sponges, and spermicide. That's what they'd have available at clinics.
Right. So Margaret Sanger ends up in Tucson and sort of begins this pretty lively movement of birth control activists in the state in early statehood days, recruiting some pretty powerful and recognizable women in Arizona history.
Right. When she went to the Phoenix area, she recruited Peggy Goldwater and May Hurd, as well as the wife of Walter Bimson, who headed the Valley National Bank, which was a really important bank in the Phoenix area at that time. In Tucson, she also met with prominent women who could provide some financial support to the clinic, and also they served as volunteers. By this time, by the 1930s, there were about 55 clinics existing in the U.S., and they all relied on the same model where they had volunteers serving as receptionists and keeping some records, volunteer doctors, and a paid nurse. Mm-hmm. So when she went to Tucson, she met with women who were interested in providing birth control for their community, and they rented a little house in an old barrio, and they called it Clinica para Madres, Mother's Health Clinic, right. And they opened it in 1934. And at this time, the Comstock Law was in effect, which made birth control illegal.
Wow.
So they operated illegally for a couple years.
They opened one in Phoenix as well later on.
Yes, they opened one in Phoenix in 1937. And it was the same type of situation where she got women from the community involved. She found a volunteer doctor and they had a paid nurse. And then they opened up and they distributed birth control.
You mentioned a few names there we should pause on, because you said Peggy Goldwater, obviously married to Barry Goldwater, former U.S. Senator here, ran for president, a Republican. May Hurd, is that the Hurd Museum Hurds?
Yes, yes. And she and her husband owned the Arizona Republic at this time, the newspaper. So they were really prominent.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about the impact of these two clinics for mothers, as they called them, in Tucson and in Phoenix in these early days. They were serving people who were poor, rural, often women of color, right?
Yes. The one in Tucson opened in a barrio, and there are photos of Margaret Sanger with a bunch of the women who use this clinic sitting on the steps of this house. And a lot of them are Mexican American. In Phoenix, they opened near the county welfare office. So it was a prominent location. It was downtown. And at this point in our history, middle class women and upper middle class women could consult physicians and get birth control because it was legalized for married women in 1936.
Married women only, okay.
Yeah, and through doctors. So at this time, a lot of people didn't go to doctors.
Right.
They didn't have formal medical services. So
Right.
these clinics were really important to women who didn't have access to physicians and didn't have money.
Right. So you've got this sort of underground system happening in the years before it's even legalized, and then it's a little bit iffy afterward. There was also a Catholic priest involved in this, which is surprising, I'm sure, to a lot of people.
Yeah, Father Emmett McLaughlin, he provided health care to his community. He was in South Phoenix. He was a priest there. He started St. Monica's Clinic because he knew people needed prenatal care. Women needed prenatal care. They needed help giving birth. And he saw the need for birth control. He was a priest for these huge families, and often they couldn't support their families. So eventually his clinic became St. Monica's Hospital, which evolved into Memorial Hospital, located on Buckeye Road and 7th Avenue. So he saw the need for birth control and he clashed with the church a lot over this.
That's really interesting.
They didn't want him to. They didn't want him to administer his hospital. And finally, he ended up leaving the priesthood.
Wow. Okay. So an advocate in many ways. I wonder, do you think most people would assume that this began with a group of socialites, many of whom were conservative at the time, and creating this thing that now is very much on the other side of the political spectrum?
Well, these women had access to contraceptives themselves, and they saw the need for it because they knew how the healthcare needs in their communities. A lot of the women had worked in some kind of TB sanitariums or hospitals where they were helping people that had, no healthcare in a sanitarium. So they had volunteered in different ways. So they saw the need for this. And I think it wasn't a political issue in that way, like it became politicized related to abortion. Some of these women were pro-choice. Peggy Goldwater was always pro-choice.
That's interesting. Yeah. Let me ask you about the religious conflicts here. You mentioned the Catholic priest involved in this and the pushback he got from the church at the time, but this was still sort of an unresolved issue even within the Catholic Church. When you're looking at large populations of especially Latino women back then, was this a religious issue for them or something that pushed back against their religion?
There's a Bishop Gehrke who was very strong against any type of birth control and was very outspoken about Catholic women not using it. And yes, a lot of the Mexican American women were Catholic, but I ended up interviewing a woman who was the director of Planned Parenthood in Southern Arizona, Virginia Lerun, who was Mexican American, who found a photo of her Mexican American grandmother in the clinic's files. And then she learned that her grandmother had used contraception because of a health issue. So I think that they used their own independence and made their decisions, even though the Catholic Church was against it.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. A little bit of Arizona history from longtime Arizona historian Mary Melker joining us. She's also the author of Pregnancy, Motherhood, and Choice in 20th Century Arizona. Mary, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for explaining this to us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. President Trump says his administration will not cut Medicaid, the health care program for low-income Americans. But budget experts say it'll be difficult, if not impossible, to achieve the reduced spending the GOP-led Congress and president want without that. Arizona is one of a handful of states with a law that automatically rolls back its Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act if federal funding falls below a certain level. The state's Medicaid program, also known as the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, or ACCESS, may also add a work requirement for beneficiaries. With me now to talk about the state of Medicaid in Arizona is Anne Marie Alameddine, President and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. Anne Marie, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, how big of a topic of conversation among people who do what you do are these potential cuts?
This is the topic of conversation among healthcare leaders, among hospitals, federally qualified health centers, doctors, nurses. This is the topic because so much is at stake in terms of What's at risk in terms of Medicaid cuts?
Well, so let's talk about what is actually at risk here. Obviously, you know, people who rely on Medicaid would lose their coverage. So there's the human cost here. There's also a potential economic cost for hospitals and other providers, right?
Absolutely. You know, Access Medicaid in Arizona is it covers 2 million lives in Arizona. So it's 2 million Arizonans who rely on Access for healthcare coverage. We estimate about 750,000 may be at risk for losing their healthcare coverage. So that has tremendous impacts to those patients who have chronic diseases, who need management, who might be in the middle of cancer treatments. It has just tremendous personal impact to those 750,000 Arizonans. And I might say, you know, some of these Arizonans might not even know that they're on Medicaid because it appears like a commercial. They have an insurance card like any one of us with employer-sponsored health insurance. So I think it's really important for Arizonans to really look at their card to see, do they in fact have Access coverage, and might their coverage be at risk of being canceled if these Medicaid cuts go into effect?
How concerned are you about the potential of the ACA Medicaid expansion being rolled back under that state law if the federal funding dips?
Very concerned, because as you indicated in the introduction, it's a trigger law that we have in Arizona that if the federal match rate, which is currently at 90%, if that goes below 80%, the hospitals no longer pay their health provider assessment tax that helps fund this population. And that expansion population could go away. It's also important to note that voters, through an initiative process, expanded Medicaid eligibility up to 100% of the federal poverty line.
Right. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's really only 100% to 133%, which is Medicaid expansion population in Arizona. So the state, through the initiative process, is still responsible for those who are up to 100% of the federal poverty limit. So lots at stake, and it is the topic of conversation. And I think we're really coming together to build coalitions to really communicate to Arizonans generally and our policymakers, our Arizona congressional delegation, in terms of what does this look like in Arizona? What does it look like in each congressional district? How will rural communities be disproportionately impacted? So that this is all on the table and transparent in terms of what policymakers decide to do.
Let me ask you about the geographical disparities here, because in the past we've heard, when this debate over expansion was happening, we kept hearing about how rural hospitals were potentially needing to close or scale back services because of the amount of uncompensated care they were providing. People with no insurance who would basically use the emergency room as a primary care provider come in and couldn't pay anything. And hospitals still are, of course, are required to provide that care. Is that still the case here, that rural hospitals could potentially have to shut down or scale back certain services?
Absolutely. Particularly when you look at the communities that in rural Arizona, they are disproportionately, the proportion of Medicaid is higher in those communities. So those hospitals rely upon that payer source of to provide care to those patients, that there is a payer via Access. So that really stabilized the whole healthcare system in Arizona, particularly in rural communities. And as hospital executives are really modeling these impacts, they're preparing. You know, if these cuts go into effect, what services might we have to close? What are the number of employees we might have to lay off so that they're prepared? But, of course, we want to get ahead of that so that does not happen, because there is certainly so much at stake. But rural hospitals, and I think hospitals, really all hospitals in the state of Arizona, will be detrimentally impacted by this. I mean, first and foremost, it's those 750,000 patients who no longer have access to healthcare coverage.
Right.
And then there's that economic impact that impacts hospitals. As enrollment goes down, we saw this during the Great Recession, as enrollment goes down, uncompensated care goes up. And then there's the cost shift to the private employers and to our premiums all going up. So it's a tremendous ripple effect. And with some really dire consequences, of course, first and foremost, going back to those patients who need coverage so that they can stay healthy. We want people to have the right kind of care at the right time. And there's a lot that can't be managed in an emergency department. That's not the proper setting for doing primary care screenings. It's good for emergencies and for trauma, But we want to people to have access to their primary care providers and to their specialists that they need to stay healthy.
Well, it seems like kind of a vicious cycle. If hospitals are treating more patients, for example, in an ER setting, but they're not getting paid for it, they have to lay staff off, that's just fewer providers, fewer nurses, fewer doctors, fewer techs to treat those additional people coming to the hospital who can no longer go to a doctor.
And I think that's important to note. Is as hospitals look to potentially, if these cuts go into effect, if Medicaid is restricted, that hospitals will be looking at service lines. What can we close to make sure that our essential core services remain open? What employees might we need to lay off? Those are decisions that hospitals do not want to make. I think, you know, we've stabilized since COVID. We've expanded healthcare services, and we want to keep on along that trajectory to meet the needs of our communities. But these cuts are unsustainable, and hospitals will have to make hard decisions, decisions we don't want to make. And we hope that Arizonans really hear this kind of call to action to really understand how this might personally affect them. It might affect their family, their friends, their neighbors. You know, it's close to 1 in 4 Arizonans have access coverage. So yeah. We all know people. Who will be impacted by this so that we can, you know, help educate policymakers in terms of what's the right decision. But, you know, you talk about healthcare workforce. We've had such a crisis in the shortages of healthcare workers. We've done so much to recruit them into the profession, to mentor them, to grow them, to develop them into the profession. You know, it's really heartbreaking to think about potential layoffs when we really need these healthcare workers to take care of patients.
Sure. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Anne Marie Alameddine, President and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. Anne Marie, thank you as always. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Sam, do you know your astrological sign?
I do. I am a Taurus.
Interesting. I am a Libra, which I've always found to be surprisingly accurate. But all of that could be thrown up in the air this month as March shapes up to be a big month, astrologically speaking.
Okay, so are we talking Mercury is in retrograde territory? Every time I hear that, it sounds bad.
It does sound bad. And yes, in fact, Mercury is in retrograde,
oh dear.
And so is Venus, and there's more. I spoke more about it all with Monica, no last name, the astrologer behind Noonlit Sage.
For me, astrology is a system of awareness of our cycles in nature and how we connect to nature. And this is something that happens whether or not you believe in astrology, right? Spring happens when the spring happens, and summer, fall, winter, so forth, right? The lunar cycles happen regardless of your belief about their impact on us. And on a physical level, they do. The tides shift. We are made of water. So on a physical level, yes, there's some changes that happen. But when you take astrology into account, you get to understand that there's themes that also reoccur, patterns that reoccur energetically. Mm-hmm. So astrology is the system that obviously has thousands of years in its history of connecting those dots energetically to the things that happen all around us in our environment. And a phrase I really love to abide by is as above, so below. Mm-hmm. So when you connect to what's going on in the cosmos, and you understand the representations of, let's say, these zodiac signs, the planets, what they are representing to us energetically, then you can kind of prepare like you would for the springtime or the summer and change and shift energetically with those currents in the cosmos.
Interesting. Okay, I've never heard it put that way. I like that. Okay, this, I understand, is a big month in the world of astrology this
yes.
coming March here. Tell us a little bit about why.
Yeah, so there's a few uncommon transits that happen every so often. You know, Venus retrograde is coming up. We're in it right now, actually. And that happens every 18 months or so. So it's a time period of specific energetic current that we go through, which I'll explain in a second here. Then we also have Mercury retrograde on top of it. That's more common. It happens about 3 times a year for about 3 weeks each. Then we have eclipses that are happening at the same time.
Yeah.
So these are things that while we go through them every so often, they're all happening at the same time. So the energies are just magnified as far as their meaning and what we should prepare for.
And your readings are probably getting complicated at this point, I'm guessing, for your clients. Okay, so I've heard the phrase, right, like Mercury is in retrograde. You know, people blame things on that basically happening. What does it mean that Venus and Mercury are in retrograde?
Sure. So let's start with what is a retrograde. A retrograde is a period of time when the energies are slowing down, and the purpose of that is to assess and reflect. So when we're busy and we're moving really fast, we don't get to really notice as much of what might be working, what might not be working for us, right? So in this time of slowing down, just like let's say you would in the winter time, you get to restore your energy. You get to recharge your energy. So when you align with that, it helps you get into alignment for the next phase.
Okay.
And so Mercury and Venus, the difference between that, they're planets that represent certain aspects of our lives and personalities.
Okay.
So with Mercury, this is something that's always going to be reflected of the communication we have. People usually tend to say things didn't work out, technology mishaps happen. just all the information and the data starts getting a little wonky because we're in a reverse mode, right? Mercury is very direct. It moves forward very fast, right?
Okay.
We're thinkers that figure things out pretty quickly here. But in retrograde, it does want you to reassess, wait a minute, was that really working for you? Maybe you need a new software, right? And then Venus is the planet that represents beauty and love and relationships. So I go further and say it's really about a time to reassess how we receive. When you have these retrogrades, we can go further and say, oh, they're in Aries and Pisces, and what does that mean? What's the theme with that? But in general, it is this major time of reflection so that we could start kind of shifting in a new direction.
Okay. New direction. I like it. Mm-hmm. What's the significance of these two eclipses we have happening all at the same time?
Yes. So the eclipses are times when there's a chapter change in our lives.
Okay.
Right. And they happen about two times a year, about 6 months apart. And so I look at it like these 6 month chapters in our lives. When we have the two eclipses, they're in pairs because one will be a solar eclipse and one will be a lunar eclipse, meaning that one will happen on the new moon and one will happen on the full moon.
Okay.
So it's kind of that connected cycle of the light inside of us is shifting and changing.
Interesting. Okay. So I wonder, because you talked about working with specific clients, right? And like, I'm sure their readings all look a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Does this kind of major astrological event affect people differently?
Yes, absolutely. So although this will all affect us on a general level, we'll all pretty much connect to some of these changes. Some people will experience much more dramatic change than others because of the way their birth chart interacts with the current astrological weather. So there is more custom work to do. Sometimes when you think of these horoscopes and online gurus with astrologies telling you everyone's going to experience this, actually, not everyone's going to quite experience it to the exact same level, which is kind of nice to know.
So, okay, I have to ask, how did you get into this? Like, how did you become an astrologer?
I have my background in psychology, actually.
Interesting.
So I was always fascinated with understanding the self and wanted to help people heal within themselves their traumas. I had, growing up, a lot of things I needed to heal. When I went to school, I wanted to become a therapist to help others heal. But then when I got to Phoenix, because of all that, I met an astrologer. I was curious to go deeper into this spiritual aspect of understanding the self. So when I had my chart read by this astrologer, everything just made 100% sense. It really resonated with me, this like deep inner truth that nothing else had quite come to that level for me to say, this is the path for you. And I just merged those two worlds for myself of healing psychology and adding in astrology, which is just another system of representing our lives, our personality, and our expression.
Background as a psychologist, not the answer I expected. What do you say to folks, or do you ever encounter people who are clients or thinking about it or at one of the events that you go to or something who just say, this is all crap?
I say, that's okay. That's okay that you feel that way. I am not here to convince anybody, right? Everybody has their own journey, and I totally respect everyone's opinions on things. I don't think my energy is best served in trying to convince everybody to get on this astrology train, and more so be there for those who are really wanting to be open
Super interesting. All right. Monica, the astrologer with Noonlit Sage, joining us to talk more about this astrological month. Monica, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Of course. My pleasure.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.